Good morning. Welcome to the House Fraud Prevention and State Agency Oversight Committee. I call the committee to order. A quorum has been established. Today we are hearing from the Department of Human Services to discuss early intensive developmental and behavioral interventions, or EIDBI programming, otherwise known as autism services. Before we get to the testimony from DHS, I want to just provide some comments that were given to me by the Sergeant at Arms. To ensure that everyone can view, hear, and understand today's proceedings, the Sergeant at Arms has asked that we provide an overview of the committee's expectations. We are asking for your cooperation in maintaining decorum and civility throughout this hearing. For the safety, security, and comfort of all attendees, please note the following guidelines. No signs or placards are permitted in the hearing room. No verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior. No applause, clapping, or audible demonstrations. No standing or sitting in the walkways and aisles. If accommodation is needed, communicate with the sergeant staff, and those are the wonderful people with the gold ties in the hearing room with us. Consequences of disruption. Failure to comply with these guidelines may result in removal from the committee room. Testifiers will be given specific time limits, which must be strictly observed, and that is 2 minutes, my friends. Tickets may have been issued, and we ask that you keep it in the event you need to re-enter the hearing room. All right. Next, we will approve the minutes from January 21st. Vice Chair Anderson, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, Madam Chair. I move approval of the minutes from January 21st meeting.
Thank you. Representative Anderson moves approval of the minutes from January 21st. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The ayes have it, and the minutes are approved. Now we will move to the presentation of the Department of Human Services. We are asking you to keep your presentation to 10 minutes. Commissioner Gandhi, welcome to the committee, and please state your name and introduce your team for the record, or you can introduce yourselves when your turn comes up. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Robbins, Lead Pinto, and committee members. My name is Shireen Gandhi, and I serve as temporary commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Thank you for asking us to appear here again today. As I have said before, DHS has a zero tolerance for fraud. My goal at DHS is straightforward. It is to make Minnesota the best state in the country when it comes to Medicaid program integrity and making sure people receive the services that our taxes fund. We are here today to discuss the Medicaid Early Intensive Developmental and Behavioral Intervention, also called EIDBI. Early diagnosis and intervention are vital to helping young people with autism reach their full potential. The legislature took important steps last session to strengthen the oversight of autism services and EIDBI program. And DHS is actively implementing these legislative changes, which include provisional licensing, eventually full licensure, and this will bring additional health and safety measures by establishing clear requirements for providers and strengthening accountability. Before that, in October 2024, DHS Office of Inspector General began conducting on-site compliance visits to autism service providers. These site visits allowed DHS to observe operations, assess compliance, identify areas where corrective action is needed. As a result, 20% of providers closed or were terminated, and the OIG has 28 active payment withholds in place. In the spring of 2025, I designated EIDBI a high-risk service. High-risk services are subject to enhanced safeguards such as revalidation with criminal fingerprint background checks and unannounced site visits. Enhanced prepayment claims review to catch improper payments before they occur, a freeze on new providers, and disenrolling inactive providers. We have also been working with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, on program integrity work, including an extensive corrective action plan. But I want to flag significant concerns that Medicaid in Minnesota is under attack. On January 6th, less than a week after the December 31st submission of our initial corrective action plan, CMS rejected that plan and stated its intent to withhold $2 billion in Medicaid funding. The threat of a $2 billion withhold would jeopardize all Medicaid services in Minnesota, including nursing homes, hospitals, and prove catastrophic for Minnesota's health care system, in addition to affecting our entire state budget. This type of withhold is unprecedented and does not reflect the substantial work Minnesota has undertaken over the last year in coordination with the federal agency. We are appealing the decision and on January 30 submitted a revised plan that incorporates CMS's recommendations and goes above and beyond strengthening programs, reducing risk, and improving our ability to detect and stop fraud more quickly. When CMS officials were visiting Minnesota last month, I asked them if they knew of another state doing more to stop fraud and improve program integrity, and they could not think of one. I take seriously our responsibility to promote the health, safety, and well-being of children and vulnerable adults, as well as our obligation to be a careful steward of a significant amount of public dollars. These autism services matter, and it is essential that they are delivered safely, appropriately, and with integrity. That's why we are taking a close review of the service, including having a vendor evaluate vulnerabilities. I also recognize that strong program integrity includes supporting providers in meeting requirements. DHS has developed additional resources for current providers and applicants to build competency and provide technical assistance. Helping providers understand expectations strengthens compliance while supporting high-quality services for children and families. Chair Robbins, I would like to have John present on our current work to strengthen oversight of EIDBI and Inspector General Clark to present on OIG's actions.
Thank you. Mr. Connolly.
Chair Robbins, good morning. John Connolly, Deputy Commissioner and State Medicaid Director at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I'll walk through a few of these slides efficiently given our timelines here and then hand it over to James. We thought to start with a mention of the vulnerability report that we recently released and just say a few notes of context about that. First of all, the reason for asking for this deliverable and having this report developed and then releasing it publicly was to create an analysis of a history of claims for 46 months to inform the enhanced prepayment review process that we recently implemented. So, understanding the contours of the benefits, the services, billing, provider networks was necessary to craft the analytics and the frameworks and the systems that we're now using for enhanced prepayment review. So that was the foundation upon which that process was built. And the less we pay and chase and the more we're proactive in preventing fraud and bad actors from stealing from taxpayers, the better. The second reason for implementing, or rather to have this report developed, was to provide recommendations for the department and for the state broadly with respect to policy adjustments or program design adjustments that would help us enhance program integrity and fight fraud. So we are digesting those recommendations based on the analysis that they've done. I think we have a series of questions about the different analytics they used, the results that they produced, the recommendations themselves. So we are digging into those different elements of the vulnerability report and the different deliverables they provided. We'd note that this is a milestone at a point in time after 90 days of work. And we do have questions about the numbers in the report, and we do have questions for the vendor. Our teams are engaging with the vendor to better refine and understand the different recommendations and the analytics that they have provided. And we'll continuously enhance and change the enhanced prepayment review analysis and framework that we're using every 2 weeks to analyze claims. So that work is ongoing, and it will evolve and improve as we do the work to improve prepayment review. Next slide. Okay, providing a little bit on this slide of a foundation and understanding of what EIDBI is, or Early Intensive Developmental and Behavioral Intervention Services. This is a required set of services as they are medically necessary for children in basically the Medicaid program. So the early and periodic screening, diagnostic, and treatment benefit is the benefit of that is required for all states to support medically necessary services of children. So Minnesota and the legislature responded to that by creating the EIDBI benefit to provide an accessible set of services and organized delivery system and provider network to offer access to these services. Before the benefit was created, children were essentially, and families were waiting years for evaluation and service, and there wasn't a readily accessible provider network. So that was what motivated the benefit. It is, again, a state-specific Medicaid benefit to meet the requirements of the Medicaid program for medically necessary services for children up to age 20 with autism spectrum disorder. Next slide. So a few notes, too, about the different controls that are in place or have been in place for the program. The first is that providers are required to meet the enrollment requirements of Minnesota healthcare programs. So those different requirements are applied to EIDBI providers just as they would be to other types of providers that enroll in the program. We do have a medical review agent under contract that looks at things like a program member's eligibility and their treatment plan to justify the services that are provided. There is prior authorization for services. There are seven key services that are included in the benefit in its design. They require prior authorization to confirm that they are in alignment with the individual treatment plan. There is claims editing in the system. We do monitor claims such that the different edits in MMIS, our claims processing system, will reject claims if they don't meet the requirements that are hard-coded into that system. And then in addition, there are recipient rights. So if patients or family members see a problem in the service that is provided or in access to care, they can use their recipient right frameworks to object or to file a grievance. Next slide. All right, at this point, I will turn it over to James to talk about our more recent program integrity advancements and the work of the Inspector General with respect to EIDBI.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Inspector General Clark, please state your name.
Good morning, everybody. James Clark, Inspector General at the Department of Human Services. Over the past year, the department has taken several important steps to increase program integrity for EIDBI services. We have increased the number of audits and on-site visits to EIDBI businesses. We have designated the service as high risk. The high risk designation allows DHS to do enhanced background studies and more frequent site visits. We have implemented payment withholds and referred suspected fraud to law enforcement. We have paused enrollment for new EIDBI businesses. We have disenrolled inactive EIDBI providers. We have implemented provisional licensure for EIDBI providers. We have enhanced our review of EIDBI billing through prepayment review, which allows us to further scrutinize claims before they are paid by the department. And we are also beginning a large-scale provider revalidation effort, which will require us to do unannounced site visits at every single enrolled EIDBI business throughout the state. Next slide. It's important to note that the legislature created EIDBI as an unlicensed program. Generally speaking, unlicensed programs have less barriers to entry and fewer standards for businesses. It's important to note EIDBI is moving to licensure, so we're starting with provisional licensure. Providers will need to apply, disclose ownership, pass background checks, demonstrate staff qualifications, and have policies and procedures in place regarding billing, staff training, and documentation that services are being provided. The deadline to apply for a provisional license is May 31st, so that deadline is coming up soon. There are currently about 500 or so unlicensed EIDBI provider agencies, and so far only six have applied for licensure. So the clock is running to get your application in to become a licensed EIDBI provider. If providers don't apply and get approved for a license by May 31st, they will no longer be allowed to operate. So that's provisional licensure. Comprehensive licensure standards are being developed and will be submitted to the legislature next year. Licensure is important and will create clear and enforceable standards for EIDBI providers related to staff qualifications, training, service delivery, client documentation, supervision, and billing. This slide shows that the department did 338 site visits to EIDBI providers between October 2024 and July 2025. Out of those 338 site visits, 54 of the businesses decided to voluntarily close, and 18 of the providers were terminated by the department for cause. So that means that about 21% of the site visits that we completed, during that time period led to EIDBI providers exiting the program either voluntarily or involuntarily. This slide also shows that CMS is asking us, as I said, to revalidate all high-risk provider agencies. So that means between now and May of 2026 of this year, we're going to be doing unannounced site visits to close to 6,000 businesses throughout the state of Minnesota, and that includes all EIDBI businesses. We're also reviewing EIDBI billing data in new ways in the Office of Inspector General. To that end, we've contracted with a private business to help with those efforts and audit EIDBI providers that are billing outliers or have billing anomalies. As for investigations, we have 102 open EIDBI investigations. That's not just into agencies, but into employees, owners, and also businesses. We have about 38 payment suspensions on EIDBI related entities, so that's employees, owners, and businesses. We've also referred suspected, as I said, EIDBI fraud to state and federal law enforcement. I think that's all I have for that slide.
John has one last one. Mm-hmm. So just a quick conclusion here. So we'll just say that certainly there is a lot of work that is happening. We know that we have more work to do to enhance the benefit and the program integrity around it. Our goal is to build a secure, sustainable benefit that provides necessary services to children that are really life-saving to help them achieve their full potential. We hope to implement reliable integrated data systems that allow us to do more proactive monitoring. That's been a key pivot point for the department. Continuously evaluate the services, the provider network, and the benefit itself, and detect risk earlier with these new tools that we're using. So again, EIDBI represents our commitment to children in Minnesota, and we want to make sure that all children have access to these life-changing services. So thank you.
Thank you all. So how we're going to structure the rest of the morning is we're going to do member discussion now because the commissioner has to leave in a bit, and then we'll do public testimony, and then we'll move on to my presentation. So we just want to make sure everyone is aware of how we're handling this. So now we are on to member questions, and I have a million, but I'm going to just start with one quick. So on the EIDBI report that Optum did, they flagged 90% of these claims as being problematic. That's a stunning number. And in the specifics, like, they talked about some very basic stuff, like some of these companies had no phone numbers. They had no website. So please tell me how those places were even allowed to bill a dime to the state when it was that sort of most basic checking that a business functioned. Commissioner Gandhi.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. I would like to have both Inspector General Clark and DC Connolly be able to respond as well. But the it is shocking that 90% of claims would be flagged, and it is important for us to do the work of looking at them and determining why each was flagged. Some are flagged rightfully so, and some we might find out the analytics were not working as intended and not catching not indicating that something was wrong. A flagged claim does not necessarily indicate fraud. It doesn't even necessarily indicate that that the service was incorrect in any way. So our analytics need to continue to be refined, and we need to do the careful work of looking at them to make sure that anything that is wrong, we are tracking that down and recouping funds if need be, doing investigations, making criminal referrals. But the flagging 90% of claims is really like not flagging anything. So we need to, if you flag everything, you flag nothing, right? So we need to understand that better. And I want to say that this work is hard, serious work. And we are doing it in the public eye, and we are being transparent with everything we can that's not going to provide a roadmap for criminals. So we are going to need to have time to go back and forth with the vendor to understand it, to do the investigations and make the changes.
Sure, I might add a couple of notes of context and agree that the 90% figure is shocking. It's very concerning. So we looked into the different analytics that produced the flagging of 90% of the claims. Two of the different analytics or tests that the vendor applied to the claims are what's producing the vast majority of these flags. And I think it's fair that we engage with the vendor to refine these such that we're being more surgical in how we look at claims. If there's billing over a certain threshold, if different combinations of the seven services raise different concerns about how providers are billing or their behavior, those are things absolutely that we should look into and that different analytics should prompt us to do. That said, it is also the case that EIDBI is one of the most clinically intensive services in the Medicaid benefit. In addition, one of the most intensive service arrays for children in the Medicaid benefit. So there are cases among those 90% of claims that were flagged by Optum where the services delivered are likely appropriate. They are appropriate for complex needs of families and children. And so we need to do the work now that we've been prompted by this report to look into those claims and sort out the ones that are appropriate through further review and the ones that actually are problematic. But certainly 90% of claims being flagged is a huge concern for us, and we'll have to dig into this with the vendor to further sort out the different analytics that we're going to apply so that we can look more closely at the claims.
Okay, quickly, Inspector General, then I have a follow-up.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I just want to follow up on this issue of, you know, businesses without websites or phone numbers. I've said it before in front of this committee. I'll say it again. Like, as a department, as a state, we need to do a better job of vetting providers on the front end.
Yes.
Right? I am 100% in agreement with that. To that end, revalidation will allow us to do increased vetting of providers. So revalidation involves us not only going to the business, right, doing unannounced site visits, but it also involves requesting from the business information about ownership, information to make sure they have the right credentials in place, or really validating that this business is who they say they are, that they're located where they say they are. So that will help with vetting.
I would just like to say the public thought that was going on. Why wasn't that already happening?
We do revalidations already for providers, particularly high-risk providers. This enhanced revalidation effort is happening at the direction of CMS, but all high-risk provider types, we do revalidation either on, it's like a three-year or a five-year schedule.
Right, a five-year cycle, yeah. Like, they didn't have a website or a phone number. So just to your point about transparency, this is the report, just so everyone knows. Like, there's not a lot of transparency here, and I am very concerned that we still don't know. And so I would like a private briefing to understand these markers, because the line is that, oh, well, we can't talk about it because it will tip off the fraudsters. Well, first of all, they already know what they're doing, clearly. So we're not tipping them off. We're just keeping it from the public. And secondly, I am just stunned that all of these things keep happening. I agree to your point about the complexity, but I'll let one of my colleagues get to a question next. But one of the reasons that we've had literally an increase in providers over 5 years, 700%. It went from 41 providers to now, one report said 328, a news report said 450. Today I heard 500. So that would be more than probably 900%. And the cost increase grew 3,000% per recipient. That is off the charts. And that should have been a flag months before CMS told you to do this, right? So that's what we're trying to get to. How are you and the department routinely seeing these anomalies and taking steps before you have to be told to do it by our committee, by CMS, by somebody else? This is a complete failure, and I know you're trying to fix it, and I want to be on Team Fix It, but we have to understand the scope of how obvious and brazen this has been. So with that, I'll turn it over to Representative Alphins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill, the enabling legislation passed in 2017. It was on a bipartisan vote in a Republican-controlled legislature. The audit report from Optum, you look at what the parts that are unredacted, it says, you know, largely it's policy issues, ambiguities and problematic policies, and I've got to believe a lot of them stem back to that 2017 legislative language. And I think that there, just about everybody at this table would like to have the opportunity to see if buried in those policy issues are things that need to be changed in the legislature. And I think we'd like to see that before first and second deadline passes so that we have the opportunity to make some of those legislative corrections this year. And if you're going to, you know, keep it, you know, 90% of the report blacked out until after our legislative deadlines, how are we going to fix these issues that in many cases are going to fall on us?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Elkins. First, I want to thank you for being on Team Fix It. That is the team that I want to be on. I understand the frustration with the blacked out report. We had only hours to do it before we released it, so our team took a quick look at it, and we're looking at it again, so there may be portions that we can, I don't know if this is a word, unredact and share. I'm also open to sharing the specifics as long as we have a forum in which we're not making our vulnerabilities public. I really care about protecting the program, protecting the taxpayer dollars, not giving anybody a roadmap of how to, anybody else, if somebody's figured it out, you know, we want to stop them. We don't want to give the roadmap to anybody else. We are working, working on fixing all of the vulnerabilities. So, and I think it is important that we have, we're able to share that with you all as partners in strengthening program integrity and making policy changes this year if we can.
Thank you. Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. I don't think you need to worry about a roadmap. The roadmap has been out there for years. It is, you know, we have hundreds and hundreds and maybe 80% of these providers are fraudulent, and they all know how to do it. And it's been very, very easy for them to do it because there's been, you know, little to no oversight. And so I don't think you need to worry about that you're going to tell the fraudster something that they don't already know, because they already know, obviously. How many providers do we have? So I see here that you say that you made 338 on-site visits. I don't know whether they were unannounced or whether you told them, I'll be out in 2 weeks, I'll have your kids and everything ready, which is what I think's been going on. And of that, 20% closed on their own or you made them close. How many providers are out there? Then I see that a number, you said there's 500 unlicensed providers and only six have applied for licensure, which is shocking. Okay, and then why are you giving them another 3 months to fraudulently bill the state before they don't have a license? Why wait until May 31? Because if these are legitimate companies, legitimate providers, they should be able to do their license in like 30 days.
Commissioner Gandhi or Inspector General Clark?
Or apply, Clark? At least.
If I can, that deadline to apply for licensure, May 31st of 2026, is in statute. So that it's a statutory deadline. I don't have the site, but it's in the provisional licensure statute, which I think is 245A.142. So that's the deadline, the statutory. In terms of the 338 site visits, because EIDBI was unlicensed and was not a high-risk provider at the time, right? So for licensed programs, we can do, by statute, unannounced site visits whenever we want. For high-risk programs, we can, by CMS regulations, do unannounced site visits whenever we want. If there's no licensure and it's not a high-risk program, we don't have the authority unless we suspect fraud to do unannounced site visits. So with these site visits so going forward, we will have the ability to do unannounced site visits whenever we want to EIDBI providers, do the licensure and the high-risk designation. But the 338, we didn't give, it was, I believe, 24 hours notice that we gave the providers before we went out there. So we had to give them advance notice. It wasn't a whole lot of notice, but it was 24 hours.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. Sorry. Who designates them as high risk? Because these have been high risk for years, obviously. Not just like in the last 2 months, 6 months.
Inspector General.
Thank you, Chair Robbins and Representative Anderson. I will defer to Commissioner Gandhi because she has the authority to designate programs as high risk.
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Anderson, I designated EIDBI high risk in the spring of 2025 after stepping into the role of temporary commissioner and taking a look at a number of programs within the Medicaid benefit. We were looking at them with data analytics to see what we could uncover in terms of trends and outliers, and looking at our services for the types of controls that when they were created either were put in place or not put in place. So that was designated high risk by me in the spring of 2025. I think it was effective in June of 2025. Yeah. We had to give 30 days notice.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. So, and thank you for doing that. So that, it was, I think, May or June or something. Yeah. So, the site visits, the announced site visits on the slide were all done before that you made them high risk. And so have we done site visits since then? And there's also, this number's 338, there's 500 unlicensed, you've had this much. So there must have been six, because these are closed, so there must have been 600 or more of these. How many are there?
Inspector General or Commissioner Gandhi, whoever.
I don't, at the time that we were doing those, I think I was told there were around 450, but I don't know currently.
Yeah, I think the number that I have is 483 with 59 additional agencies pending approval. So that's where I got to the 500 or so. So it's a little over 500, but 483 are enrolled right now. How we got to the 388 number is that we prioritize site visits off a review of billing, staff qualifications, and prior visit history. So some of these provider agencies weren't a high priority to visit at the time because maybe they hadn't billed us, maybe they were brand new, maybe we had been there recently. So that's why we didn't go to every single EIDBI provider agency. But again, what I will stress now is that due to our revalidation efforts, by May, we are going to go and do unannounced site visits to every provider that so chooses to be revalidated, right? So during revalidation, some providers might say, I don't want to go through the revalidation process, so they would be disenrolled, right? But the ones that choose to be revalidated, choose to provide their ownership information, choose to provide documentation to show that they have the right credentials in place, right? There's licensed professionals that need to be involved in each of these agencies. Those providers that choose to continue providing services, choose to go through revalidation, we will do unannounced on-site visits to all of those providers.
I'm sorry, I don't
Vice Chair Anderson.
Okay, the numbers, so 500 plus the 54 that closed on their own, plus the 18 that we closed on this sheet. So that's 600 almost that existed. Is that...
I don't believe
I'm just trying
so. Maybe
to,
I'm not understanding the question correctly.
Okay.
At a point in time. So, sorry. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, you're not.
Okay.
So, Vice Chair Anderson, clarify the question. Then, Inspector General, you can answer.
Okay. I'll ask a different question. The 54 that closed on their own and the 18 that were terminated for cause, my assumption is that the vast majority of those were fraudulent. Okay. And have all of those been sent to law enforcement to take a look at their past billing and for potential charges?
Inspector General.
Chair Robbins, Representative Anderson, I don't know if all of them have been sent to law enforcement. The compliance visits didn't all see fraud, right? We saw issues with, you know, staff maybe not having qualifications, maybe not having ownership disclosures, but not all of those visits uncovered, right, billing for services not provided or intentionally billing us for services not provided or criminal actions. I will say that when we do see evidence of fraud, we do make referrals to law enforcement, but not all of those site visits involved us uncovering evidence of fraud.
Okay, I want to jump in here with a question because we had this in one of the last hearings. On adult day services, I believe, if I'm remembering right, or it could have been assisted living, when they do site visits, they don't even check the books. So are you checking the financials as part of these site visits?
As a part of the, Chair Robbins, thank you for the question. As a part of the compliant site visits that we did, the 338, yes, we were looking at billing history and looking at financial information. So yes.
Thank you. Sorry, Vice Chair Anderson, anything left? Okay. Okay, so that leads me to another question. I have had whistleblower reports in the last month saying that your unannounced site visits are not unannounced. And you've now said that you give them 24 hours notice. Other people say they're getting letters saying that they should know that to expect a site visit within 30 or 60 days. So describe for me if there's truly any unannounced site visits where you just show up and they have no idea you're coming.
Chair Robbins, the answer is yes. There are truly unannounced site visits. I think where some of the confusion is happening is that through revalidation, right, we have to give them notice that they're going through the revalidation process, right? So we provide them notice saying, you're going through revalidation. Here's what to expect through revalidation, right? You're going to have to provide information about ownership. You're going to have to provide credentialing information, and there will be a site visit, right? So they get notice, right? And that's required by state statute that we have to give them notice. But the date, time, when we show up, they're not getting advance notice about that. But they are getting notice that they're going through the revalidation process, and that's required under state law, right? So when a provider sees it's revalidation time, they know that there's going to be a site visit that comes along with that, and we have to notify them of that under state law.
Thank you. And what about when you give them 24-hour notice? Why do you do that?
Chair Robbins, so that was because EIDBI was not a high-risk provider type, and it was not licensed, right? Licensed programs, we have statutory authority to do unannounced site visits. For high-risk provider types, we have authority to do unannounced site visits. If it's an unlicensed and not a high-risk provider type, I believe under state, either state or federal regulations only allow us to do unannounced site visits as a part of like a fraud investigation, right? So these were not fraud investigations, they were compliance investigations. Therefore, we were required to give 24-hour notice. But going forward, right, for EIDBI providers, now because they're gonna be licensed and now because they're high risk, we will have the authority to do unannounced site visits whenever we would want.
So do you need more authority so you can do unannounced site visits even if they're not licensed? Because there's a lot of these still to go that are these waivered services that don't have licensure. So do you need more authority from the state to say, yes, you can do unannounced site visits as you need to inspect for fraud or compliance?
Chair Robbins, I mean, yes, right? And I think that's something that the legislature should look into, a blanket authority to give the department the ability to do unannounced site visits for any reason that it so chooses. We just don't have that authority right now. So that could be a legislative fix to look into.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll just remember that unless it's high risk is the caveat right to that, right? And they have the authority to do that.
Designated as right.
Yeah, designated authority to do it. So this is somehow abdication of responsibility here, leaning and telling us that we need to be putting the absolute prescriptive nature into law about how they should already be doing their job to protect the taxpayer. I'm not trying to express any greater level of outrage over this, but like, that's your job. That's your job. So when I think about this, I'm also like concerned about the qualified supervising professionals And I'm curious, if there is approximately 600 providers, how many qualified supervising professionals are there, especially if they need to be inside of every facility?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Schultz, our current data shows that we have 809 qualified supervising professionals.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what are their qualifications and how do you verify that?
Commissioner Gandhi, or?
Yeah.
Christy, if you would introduce yourself. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Christy Graham with the Department of Human Services. Representative, qualified supervising professionals generally have a mental health professional kind of licensure. There's several requirements that are listed out in statute in 256B0949. It's pretty complex, but you can take a look at those, and those are documented when providers enroll for the service. And as we move into licensure, we'll be checking for those qualifications as well.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you. So based upon what you just provided, do you verify those details that they are qualified currently?
Ms. Graham.
Madam Chair, Representative, I would perhaps defer to Mr. Conley on the provider enrollment process, but my understanding is providers attest, and there are documentation requirements that they have to provide to ensure that they are qualified.
Mr. Conley, anything to add?
Chair Robbins, not at this time. I think if there's a request for more specific information, we can certainly give that to you, Representative.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That appears to be a gap in the system right there. We just heard it right there. And so the next question then would be, do the qualified supervising professionals, are they allowed to diagnose kids as having autism?
Ms. Graham.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not a clinician, and most of us up here I don't think are either, so certainly I would want to get back to you, but the CMDE provider, the individual that does the comprehensive multidisciplinary evaluation to determine, you know, what the individual treatment plan includes, would definitely confirm what diagnoses an individual has to be able to qualify for that service, and it could be something on the autism spectrum disorder or related conditions.
This, thank you, Madam Chair. This yes. appears to be an area where it needs additional work to ensure that we have the program integrity measures around it. I do have additional questions, but I'll defer to a later time.
Great. And I would just like to follow up on this because this has been something that I've been reading in the Optum report and in other reports. And my concern, we have worked really hard to figure out how there have been multiple reports of fake autism diagnoses. We have been trying to get to the bottom of that. Where are the medical professionals who gave these fake diagnoses and why aren't they held accountable yet? And one of the concerns is the use of these QSPs. And the qualified supervising professionals, like the fact that you don't know whether they're allowed to give the diagnosis that qualifies them for these services is very concerning. Because if they're the ones who are qualifying these kids and then also coming up with the individual treatment plan that shows the intensity of treatment that is how much these kids are being billed for, they work for the provider. So a QSP works for the provider, they qualify the kid, they come up with the level of treatment that's billed for. And we have seen that the level of billing has gone up 3,000%. This is a huge issue. We need to understand if these QSPs are the ones providing these diagnoses and inflating the billing through the roof, which we know from court documents, a lot of times they inflated the billing and people got a higher kickback based on how much their kid was getting billed for. Like, this is the crux of it. And you don't know if they're the ones doing it. And their incentive, because they work for the provider, is to inflate the billing and is to qualify as many kids as possible. We have a case, I believe it was the Star Autism Center, where the QSP made sure every single kid was qualified. So I would like to hear from someone on that. Why do you not know this? And why is this not like a glaring, flashing red light for you guys? Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, thank you for that question. Starting with Star Autism Services, I do want to say that that was a center that was on our radar. That was a center that we worked with law enforcement on, and we did have an investigation that predated. So our team was on top of that one. I hear what you're saying about the QSPs. It'll be important. There are people at DHS, maybe not here today, that will be able, that I will go back to and look for those answers. I hear what you're saying about the alignment of the diagnoses and then therefore providing the treatment and billing. Part of the vendor report that we did was to look at vulnerabilities and overlaps like that, in order to give us indications of where we needed to either close gaps, as Representative Schultz was saying, or tighten requirements, separate, create stronger internal controls that separate specific actions like that. So while I don't have the details for you, we are digging into that.
Thank you. All right, Representative Schultz, you had one more.
Thank you. So this is just a, this can be kind of a data analytics question for you all. So if we have these roughly 600 providers, how do they match up with where the population of the state is? And is there any hub and center of where these autism centers are located? Or are they geographically dispersed per the population?
Inspector General.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Schultz. So I don't have an exact answer. I will say, tell you that I'm concerned about these issues too, right? High concentrations of providers in certain areas, buildings that have a high concentration of providers. I mean, that is a red flag. And to that end, our data team has created a geolocation map so we can see those kind of concerning trends. So I don't know the exact breakout. I will say that I believe, right, the majority, a disproportionate amount of EIDBI centers are in the Twin Cities metro area. Hennepin and Ramsey County probably having the vast majority. But I can get you exact. I mean, if you want exact breakdown in locations, we can get you that information.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you. So I think that as we look at this, like, you all need to be doing that. You need to be doing that well through your data analytics. And then the next question just naturally is to ask if, based upon the population of students and kids that are impacted by autism, are they geographically condensed into one area, or are they throughout the state? And how do our providers match with the need across the state? So that's my next question.
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Schultz, that is the type of work that our data analytics team is doing.
Thank you. Okay.
Madam Chair,
all right, one more.
Yep. No, so my big question here is really, are we seeing the fraud that we've seen has appeared to come from one particular population in Minnesota? Is there something about the way that you're going about your oversight over this program where you're almost discriminating in the way that you're looking at the oversight measures for different providers?
Commissioner Gani.
Chair Robbins, Representative Schultz, can you say more about that? I don't understand the question.
Representative Schultz.
So in the indictments that have been done over autism services, we've seen it largely in one population. Does your level of oversight and your look into the providers across autism services, EIDBI, are they concentrated into one area? Are you focused upon the whole list of providers? And have you placed any additional attention into any one area of the service providers?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Schultz, I think what we are trying to do is use investigation methods that are going to catch the most amount of fraud, to be the strongest tools. And so data analytics looks at trends and outliers. As I mentioned, we also are looking at program design, how the program was originally designed and passed into legislation, to focus our attention. If we focus on a particular community, that may blind us to fraud in other areas. So I believe looking at this analytically with data based on what we're seeing in billing is the best approach to catch the most fraud.
Thank you. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is a good line of inquiry, but I'm wondering what does the statute have to say about who is qualified to provide the diagnosis of autism?
Commissioner Gandhi or Ms. Grom?
Madam Chair, Representative Elkins, my understanding is statute reads that the comprehensive multidisciplinary evaluation, which I mentioned in my previous response, is what determines medical necessity. And medical necessity would be constituted in this case by having an autism diagnosis or related condition.
Okay, just qualification.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. But and who is, does it say anything about who's qualified to make that diagnosis? Yeah.
Madam Ms. Chair, Grum. Representative, yes, the statute does outline the qualifications of comprehensive multidisciplinary evaluation providers.
Okay.
I don't have those off the top of my head, but related to the qualified supervising professional that puts together the individual treatment plan and oversees that those services are provided properly according to clinical and medical requirements, those individuals are typically licensed by a board themselves. So it's, as I mentioned earlier, mental health professional or other variations of qualifications that are overseeing that the services are delivered properly.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to see if it was laid out in statute. It is. Thank
yes.
you.
Representative Anderson.
Yeah, thank you. Help me understand. So I would think that someone that has severe autism, okay, not just slightly on the spectrum, because most of us are on the spectrum, probably. So, but severe autism, that's a serious medical issue. And services should be provided by medical professionals in those cases, not just one person per center that has a license that maybe working at multiple centers, right, from what I read. Okay, so one person is the licensed, you know, over five centers. But the actual physical services are provided by 18 and 19-year-olds in many cases. And is that the way this program is set up? Is that legal that an 18 or 19-year-old with no education and any thing to deal with healthcare can actually provide these services, or is it just one person as a clinical director or whatever, and they could be a director of multiple clinics, you know, but the actual services are provided by people that are wholly unqualified to provide healthcare services? Is that how this is?
Commissioner Gandhi or
Chair Robbins, Representative Anderson. The points you're making are very important, right? We too share those concerns about potential lack of true clinical supervision at some of these autism centers, right? So if you have a qualified professional, right, so the licensed professional that's supposed to be overseeing the delivery of services, right, so they're the true clinical professional, mm-hmm. There's nothing currently in statute that limits the amount of providers that a licensed qualified professional can be affiliated with and oversee, right? So that there is a program design gap there. So we have questions, right? Is this clinical professional actually overseeing service delivery at 5, 6, 7 mm-hmm. different autism centers, mm-hmm. right? So that's a program design gap there. In terms of the employees that actually can be delivering like interventions or direct treatment to kids at these centers, right? those qualifications are laid out in statute, right? So you have a CMDE, they're at the top, you have a QSP, you have a level one provider, level two provider, level three provider. Once you get down to the level three provider level, and again, this is all laid out in statutes, right? The qualifications are just not that much, right, to be a level three autism provider. So we're talking about, I think you need to be like over the age of 18, maybe have a fluency like in another language besides English, maybe some online training, right? So this gets back to program design and what we're being asked to do to oversee these programs that do have some of these design flaws or issues with them, right, that make oversight difficult. But I think you're spot on in terms of we need to look into true clinical supervision and what that should look like in autism centers, and then also qualifications of recipients. But all this is outlined in statute.
Representative. Thank you. So it's outlined in statute as not adequate, right? So to your points. So is that your opinion too? I mean, I look at this and it's like you can do an online class and then you're do, you know, provide medical services to kids with autism. Is it your opinion that we should relook at the statutes and actually have medical things for medical services provided?
Inspector General.
Chair Robbins, Representative Anderson. I'm not a clinician, right? I've never delivered autism services. I've never, you know, I know very little about diagnoses or how this service is actually looks. So I'm probably the wrong person to ask about this. But I think, I mean, as a general, you know, idea, I think, you know, the legislature should look at, right, seriously, the qualifications for providers that we allow to provide services in our Medicaid program.
Yeah, thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, Ms. Grum.
Representative, these are important questions. I mean, to your point, I think your general point here is that this is a medical service and it's overseen by medical professionals. So the qualified supervising professional oversees all of the work that's happening on any individual's case plan. That is a mental health licensed professional, that is a behavior analyst licensed professional, that could be a pediatrician, an MD, as well as other licensed professionals. So these are qualified licensed professionals that are prepared and qualified to deliver medical services. In some cases, there are different levels and tiers of providers. For example, the level three provider is tantamount. They're not going to have the same responsibility and role that a level one provider or a QSP would have in the service delivery system. So just like in medical, you know, service delivery in medical settings, there could be medical assistants and they have lower level qualifications. So there's a complement of qualifications within the service itself. But of course, as Mr. Clark mentioned, we're happy to go back and work with you to identify any gaps that there might be there.
Thank you. I'm just going to move on. Our friends on the other side, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to echo what Representative Elkins and I think Representative Anderson are getting at, like, it is very frustrating. I think we passed a law because we all believe that these kinds of services should go to the people that need it, and we want to make sure that they get the services they need. And it sounds like the way there's a program design issue that we sort of continue to come back to in these situations. And so we are not the HHS committee. I think, I don't know if anybody here is on there, but I do think that this question that Representative Elkins asked, which is it feels like there is an urgent need to ensure that what we have learned is the program was not designed either to protect taxpayer dollars or, and I think equally important, to provide people the services that they need from the professionals that they need them. And I imagine that a piece of the flexibility is that we have a workforce crisis and there's all sorts of reasons that we always hear from a provider's perspective that we do things. But we should design these programs not from a provider's perspective, but from the ultimately the communities that are need to be served and are being impacted, the kids and in many cases families and adults. And so I hope when we, again, to the deadline question that Representative Elkins raised, and I think that Representative Anderson is getting at, is this year we should look at some of those program design issues and where we need to plug the holes. And then I think on the longer term, we need to be looking at providing, thinking about this not from a private provider center focus, but from a communities we are served and how we most efficiently do that to provide what the taxpayers and what our voters have asked us to provide and do it in the way that gives people the best and high quality services. So I hope that in the committees of jurisdiction that designed these programs, that these conversations are happening this year and happening before first deadline.
Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe just clarifying that or getting my head around it. So the comprehensive licensure standards will include recommendations regarding training and documentation and staff qualifications. So in theory, would address some of what we're discussing. But of course, that won't happen until recommendations are made in 2027, and then we'd have to pass them. And like, from the perspective of the agency, is it a time issue? Like the comprehensive licensure standards will address some of the things we've been discussing for the last few minutes or not?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Lead Pinto, thank you for that question. Yes, I think we provided this committee the number of reports that were done to help us prepare for licensure that led to passing the path to licensure. There are more recommendations coming in the governor's budget for this service, and also look forward, as Representative Greenman suggested, Representative Elkins and others of you, to look at additional ways that we can tighten the program coming out of the information in the vulnerability assessment. There's things that we can do that are within our discretion at the agency, and we certainly will do those, but anything that we need legislative action on, we will be working with you and requesting your support on that.
Thank you.
That's fine. Thank you, Madam.
Thank you. So I have one more question, but I want to signal that the public testifiers, you are next. And so first up will be James O'Neill. So if you can just be making your way to the testimony table in a minute. So I just want to focus on, for my last question, something Representative Schultz brought up, which is this attestation part. So you allow the QSPs and whoever else to just attest that they're qualified. And it seems like you also allow attestation for who owns these autism centers, which I will get to later in my presentation. Could you just outline what are all the things that are allowed under attestation? Because it seems like the whole thing is a house of cards based on attestation. And do we, in the revalidation, are you now still relying on attestation, or in revalidation, are you requiring documentation of these things? Commissioner Gunn.
Chair Robbins, I might ask Inspector General Clark to comment also, or Connolly, on if it's on provider enrollment. But attestation is an important point because it allows us to it allows us to take action against somebody if they attest to something that isn't true. So it is an important control. However, it is not sufficient, in my opinion. And so wherever we do not have stronger controls than that, I think that is something that needs to take place.
Ms. Grant.
Madam Chair, I was just going to indicate, it's my understanding when providers do enroll that they're required to submit the supporting documentation indicating, you know, sharing their license with us and the other qualifications. So we do, it's not just an attestation. They're submitting supporting documentation that we can confirm and verify to ensure they're qualified.
Okay, but clearly that hasn't happened on ownership or on these QSPs. So we need somehow in this revalidation process to make sure what they're submitting is correct. And if for some reason you have reason to believe not, that then you follow up on that, because the layers of problems here is legendary. But on the QSPs, this is another point we might need to deal with in statute. 24 of the QSPs who are responsible for the daily oversight of these clinics live out of state. How can they be doing their job if they live out of state? And why have you allowed that to continue?
Madam Chair, I would say that was a conversation in end of session negotiations last year, and we would love to continue that conversation with Chair Schumacher and Chair Knorr.
To me, that's like something that should be shut down immediately. Like, if they're at the QSP responsible for these clinics, how can they be doing their job from out of state? All right. So thank you for your time and testimony. I will follow up. I would love to do the private briefing on the vulnerabilities and invite anyone who wants to join. And Mr. O'Neill, we welcome you to the committee. The other testifiers, you can join him at the table now. Thank you. Mr. O'Neill, please state your name for the record, and we look forward to your testimony.
James O'Neill. Chair Robbins, Ranking Member Pinto, and committee members, thank you for today's hearing. I am Jay O'Neill, representing Autism Treatment Association of Minnesota, or ATAM, a nonprofit organization of about 30 member agencies all working to make effective therapy accessible to all Minnesota families affected by autism spectrum disorders. I am also the owner and president of Behavioral Dimensions in St. Louis Park. We provide in-home and telehealth services using the principles of applied behavior analysis under the EIDBI Medicaid benefit to roughly 140 clients in both metro and rural areas since 2018. ATAM works with numerous autism service providers to address clinical and administrative questions, share resources, and help each other navigate complex EIDBI compliance. There are an incredible number of steps that must occur prior to, during, and after any services are delivered to a child client. Prior to Medicaid enrollment, each individual provider who delivers services must complete a DHS background study, sign a DHS provider agreement, and attest to meeting the criteria for the level of services such as the QSP level 1, 2, or 3, supply proof of college transcripts, diplomas, certifications, and licenses, and then get DHS approval. Each provider completes a comprehensive evaluation of the client followed by the development of an ITP, both developed with and signed by the guardian and licensed professional prior to approval from the state medical reviewer. As services are delivered, we ensure all training and supervision is provided according to DHS requirements. Many of the agencies who utilize the principles of ABA have a hierarchy of training and supervision based on decades of research. State licensed and nationally certified professionals train lower-level professionals to implement the ITPs. We must document every billable session with information required by DHS. We welcome DHS audits and legislators' evaluation of our programs so that we can receive feedback and continue to demonstrate enormous return on investments to clients, families, and the taxpayers. Minnesota's EIDBI service providers want to be nation-leading examples of success. Until very recently, ATAM and DHS had good ongoing collaboration and engagement on developing, implementing, and assessing EIDBI policies. ATAM is committed to fraud prevention, and we respectfully ask DHS and legislators to engage with trusted providers as partners in designing strategies that can both protect taxpayer dollars and ensure children's timely access to care. Thank you, and I welcome questions.
Thank you. I think we'll go through everyone's testimony and then see if there's any questions. Okay, next up is Dr. Eric Larson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Robbins and members of the committee. I'm a licensed psychologist and also a licensed behavior analyst, and therefore both a QSP and a CMDE provider. And I serve as a chair of the Autism Treatment Association of Minnesota. The context here is that the lifetime costs of autism are widely accepted to range from $1 to $5 million per child for their lifetime. And early intervention is also widely accepted to be important in bending that cost curve downward. Yet families have had to advocate, such as Brad Trahan here sitting next to me, have had to advocate over the past 30 years to get access to the effective forms of early intervention, because insurance companies in the past routinely placed caps on their share of coverage and imposed controls over the kinds of supervision and oversight that are necessary to provide high quality treatment. In 2013, the state passed a new law authorizing the EIDBI TEFRA program. And this program was designed to cover the full cost of the expertise needed to provide effective treatment and also individualize the complicated treatment. So the system was built to evaluate every 6 months the level of services each child would receive. And instead of paying too much for the children who were low needs and too little for the children with high needs, find the sweet spot, the right level of services based on the child's responsiveness to treatment. Yet today, in the effort to fight fraud, the risk and the kinds of AI supervision, AI analysis that resulted in 90% of the claims being questioned is risking that we're going to go back to this broad brush, simplistic management of the program and not continue to provide the high level of supervision and oversight that each child needs to reach cost-effective levels of treatment. So what we're looking at, because so much of the problem of the pandemic came from lack of direct site visits and oversight by the Department of Human Services, we're recommending to continue to provide the high level of quality that the EIDBI program envisioned, utilize licensed behavior analysts such as myself to provide independent direct observation regularly at these centers and home-based programs, read the actual treatment plans that are developed for the children, observe the treatment in real time, and evaluate the competence of the providers during these on-site inspections. This would be done by skilled licensed behavior analysts rather than regulators who do not have the skills to understand what they're seeing during the site visits. Equally important is to engage the parents with direct on-site interviews to identify any concerns that they have, but also to evaluate whether the parents have actually been fully informed of the services they're getting and the treatment claims that are being filed on their behalf. These interviews can also help identify parents who are accepting kickbacks for placing their children in illegitimate programs.
Thank you. Please try to wrap it up. We have to get going.
Thank you. I'll defer to Mr. Trahan, who has very important information to share.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Trahan. Please state your full name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Trahan. Thanks for having me. My name is Brad Tran, former chair of the Minnesota Autism Task Force back in 2012, and a parent of a son, Reese, age 25 years old, with severe autism and still living at home with my wife and I. Every official who helped create or allowed to continue the now plainly visible culture of negligence within our state agencies must be held accountable. Oversight was treated as a formality that was never carried out. Accountability was dismissed as too burdensome rather than embraced as a fundamental responsibility of public service. When government fails in that duty, it's never the powerful who suffer the consequences. It's the most vulnerable. The question we may ask, or what we need to ask, is how do we get here? It was all preventable. We got here through a combination of rapid program expansion, insufficient oversight, and a system that prioritized access without building equally strong accountability and common sense safeguards. That imbalance created an opening for bad actors who pounced on this opportunity. The fraud is infuriating. It's a betrayal. In 2012, Minnesota lawmakers from both parties came together to pass strong, meaningful autism insurance reform at the state level. We honored every mandate that then-Governor Dayton asked of us. However, the one mandate Governor Dayton didn't ask of us was to anticipate autism therapy fraud. Then in 2016, after 13 years and 8 months, Mayo Clinic's self-insured employer stepped up to provide coverage for employee dependents, furthering strengthening access and setting a responsible example. This fraud undermines years of bipartisan work and risks harming the very individuals the system was designed to protect. This fraud damages our future by means of reduced access to services. Private and self-insured may reconsider the scope of autism coverage and increase public doubt about autism services. The money's gone. Accountability is all we have. For parents and individuals with autism, accountability is not political. It's personal. We live every day fighting for services. We have been knocked down before, but we never get knocked out. We demand transparency. We demand reform. And we demand that those responsible answer what happened, because the individuals and families who rely on these services, as well as taxpayers, deserve nothing less. In closing, to anyone in the Minnesota government who allowed billions of fraud, why wouldn't you hold any of those individuals accountable? Thank you for the opportunity to testify in front of this committee.
Thank you. And would you also like to testify, ma'am? I don't have you on my list.
Sorry, Jody McCarthy. I'm a citizen.
Okay.
And I've worked in government for a number of years. And I, too, am appalled at what's happened here. But it comes down to something very basic. We are all self-governing citizens of the United States of America and of Minnesota. We voluntarily pay taxes to take care of our vulnerable. So we have hired, I went to one of the meetings on prevention where Erin Campbell, the head of the budget and of all HR, testified to us that she does not know her legislatively mandated job and she does not do it. She didn't deny it. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh, good, now something's going to happen. I've seen nothing happen. It really does come down to something very basic. We decide what we want for our people. We know that they're being paid by taxpayer dollars, so everyone needs to be held accountable to their job. What is your job? Do you know what your job is? I listened to a panel up here today tell me that they don't know what their job is. Not one of them up here knows what their job is. A year ago, or they hired an investigator. But when you asked him what he investigated and how it was investigated, he couldn't tell you. That's where my taxpayer dollars are going? We need to stop this. And we need to stop it at some very basic levels. Erin Campbell needs to be held accountable. She needs to step down and put somebody in who will be. She has the authority to hire people to go into each program to help where they need help. And there's going to be times when people need help. But she has that authority. So we should be putting people in there to help when they need help. But we absolutely have to keep people accountable to the programs. Those programs are funded. They're funded by taxpayer dollars. There are people out there shoveling. There are people out there laying blocks. There are people out there working really hard labor jobs and giving a part of their labor that these things can be withheld and held up. I want the kids with autism to get the care that they need. And yes, right now, I suppose there's some question if they're going to get that or not, because I've got to be honest with you. I could take a pencil and a pad of paper and go in and manage that office better than it's being managed right now. All you have to do is define what needs to be done and hold people accountable.
Thank you. You're out of time, and we have another testifier standing by the door. Yes, so if someone could make room for our next testifier, and then we'll see if there's any questions from members, and then I'm not used to being done at 10 o'clock, so we got to keep moving here, people. Please, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, I'm Nathaniel M. Olson, the disability advocate from the state of Minnesota. And again, we heard the Department of Human Services speak out again, but I kind of wanted to make somebody, the Department of Human Services, aware about something that happened on the news a week ago. We had one of our own Minnesota citizens went homeless for 8.5 months. Where was accountability then? When were you going to tell the Fraud Oversight Committee that this autism person went homeless for 8.5 months? Do you know how cold it is in the state of Minnesota? It was cold in January. Governor Walz doesn't care what's happening to the American citizens. What he only cares about is fighting ICE and blaming Trump. This needs to stop. There's another person that the Minnesota Reform is talking about that is going to go homeless. This is crazy. The Department of Human Services needs to do their job. Madam Chair, I'm actually would like you to write a letter to the federal government, because the federal government needs to do a full investigation on the Department of Human Services.
I did write a letter asking for a full audit by CMS last July, and now they are working on it.
This is outrageous. How many people are going to suffer under this state? How many? This needs to stop right now. The Department of Human Services needs to do their job, because Governor Walz only cares about the illegal immigrants that we can protect. They're not helping. It is time to put Minnesota citizens first. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, so quickly, members, does anyone have any questions for our testifiers? Okay. Well, thank you all very much for coming. It really great. We greatly appreciate the perspective you bring and your advocacy on behalf of vulnerable Minnesotans and taxpayers. And now I think I have a presentation, but I'm nervous about getting to Representative Hudson's bill, so we're going to flip the order, and Representative Hudson, if you would present your bill, we'll do that first because we want to make sure we get it moved on to another committee. Welcome to the committee, Representative Hudson. Please describe your bill. Oh, I have to move the bill, I think.
Much appreciated.
Oh, you can move the bill. You're a member of the committee. Please move your bill.
I would like to move House File 3542 with a recommendation that it be referred to the Children and Families Committee.
Yes. Okay. Representative Hudson moves his bill, and it is properly before the committee. Representative Hudson, please explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me begin with a apology and ask for accommodation by Lead Pinto. There was work going on with this bill literally at the 11th hour, and by that I mean 11 o'clock last night. So I haven't had the opportunity to properly discuss with you what we're thinking in terms of how this bill should move forward to children and families. So we're going to have a nice open discussion about it right here today. So in current statute, there is a provision that allows the commissioners of Human Services and Children, Youth, and Families to disclose the existence of an investigation if they deem that it will not compromise a current investigation. And the current language says that they may do this. Our intention, in order to increase transparency to both the public and especially to the legislature, is to change that may to a must. My understanding is that Lead Pinto has an amendment that I look forward to considering, so we can get to that quickly.
Yes. So thank you. Briefly, is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify about the bill? Otherwise, we'll move to the amendment. All right. Lead Pinto, you have the A2. Would you like to explain your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it was partly, and I wonder if we could maybe have the department just provide comment on the bill. The concern is that, oh, I was muted. Look at that. Okay, thanks. I'm hoping I'm not muted now. Accidentally. Oh, because my laptop. There we go. In any case, Madam Chair, wondering if we could have the agency comment. But my concern with the way the bill was drafted is not the change from may to must. That's good. We want transparency. But we want to make sure that it wouldn't compromise the investigation, and the original bill crosses out that phrase. So I'm wondering if maybe we could get just input from that perspective.
Yes. Mr. Conley or Inspector Clark, would you care to join us? Since you're back at the table, please start by saying your name again. Thank you.
Chair Robbins, Lead Pinto, John Connolly, Deputy Commissioner and State Medicaid Director at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I think the main concern that I just highlight, and then of course refer it to the Inspector General for more perspective, is if we are required in every instance to disclose a payment withhold, it in essence will tip off agencies that may be committing fraud, or organizations that may be committing fraud before an investigation is matured enough. And we wouldn't want to disrupt those situations when law enforcement's investigating and then a provider or an agency or organization would have kind of a warning that investigation was occurring and therefore be able to falsify records, hide information, things of that nature to prevent the investigation from basically reaching the conclusion that it's aiming to reach. So with that, maybe I'll stop and have Inspector General Clark supplement.
Inspector General Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be brief. It's not a hypothetical. Disclosure does oftentimes lead to compromising investigations. This is currently happening in our state. It's currently happening with our investigations that we have. I know law enforcement, when I was at the Attorney General's office, it happens. Tipping off the subject allows them to destroy evidence, coordinate their stories, or flee the state or the country. We oftentimes see, unfortunately, unscrupulous providers, when they get wind that we're investigating them for fraud, they start to threaten or try to influence vulnerable adults, recipients in those programs to try to get them to change their tune. We also see, unfortunately, bad actors try to falsify or tamper with documents. So I do have some serious concerns about a requirement that we need to disclose to people that are under investigation, that they're under investigation, that can have all sorts of unintended and bad consequences.
Thank you, and I think we all agree with that. Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So given that, I prepared the A2 amendment, which would require disclosure within 30 days, just as the bill would, but would allow that disclosure to not happen if there's a determination that it would compromise the investigation. So it'd be the disclosure of an investigation would have to happen within 30 days unless it would compromise the investigation. And so would offer that, and I think that achieves the goal of transparency, but also achieves the goal I know that we all share, which is to make sure that we get payments, fraudulent payments stopped, and hold accountable the people who are doing it.
Thank you. Is there any discussion on the A2? Would you like to comment, Representative Hudson?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. And thank you, Lee Pinto, for the amendment, and thank the agency staff for expressing their concerns. And as you stated, 100%, we absolutely share that concern. Very much appreciate the feedback from the agency, appreciate the concern from Lee Pinto. And I agree that we most certainly do not want to tip people off who are unaware of the fact that they're under investigation. However, the text of this particular amendment, to my mind, completely hollows out the intent of the underlying amendment, which is to compel disclosure in cases where it wouldn't result in tipping off somebody that they're under investigation. And so we do have a verbal amendment that's been prepared and that nonpartisan can read after we consider the A2, but my recommendation would be to pass on the A2 as drafted with the assurance, my assurance to Lee Pinto, that the intention of what he's trying to accomplish here is something that we intend to bake into the cake as it moves forward to future committees.
Can I?
Thank you. Yes, Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I ask Representative Hudson, I guess I'm unclear about how the A2 would work against the goal of your bill, in that it would require disclosure unless that disclosure would interfere with the investigation. So I guess I'm unclear. I'm not quite seeing the conflict there.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Lee Pinto. Yeah, I suppose my premise was unstated as to what the negating fact would be. So what it does, this is about discretion, right? It's about the agency having discretion to determine whether or not disclosure would impede an investigation. What we want to clarify, the entire intent of the underlying bill is to remove that discretion so that we know that and I think it'll become clear in the verbal amendment that we present, that the intention is to provide objective circumstances where the existence of an investigation must be disclosed so that it's black and white, open and shut, no discretion from the agency, but at the same time not compromising an investigation that the subject is unaware of.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I gather that you're thinking, Representative Hudson, that that if payments are suspended or reduced or withheld, then the entity under investigation would know about that. I picked up from Mr. Connolly's testimony that that might not actually be true, that somebody could have a payment be withheld and not know that that's the case. Maybe Mr. Connolly could just clarify that, because that's what I was hearing him say, which seems sort of odd to me and probably seems very odd to you, Representative Hudson, so I'd love to get that clarified.
Mr. Conley.
Chair Roberts, Lee Pinto, I'll refer that one to Inspector General Clark.
Inspector General.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Pinto, So yes, when the department takes action to reduce, suspend, or withhold payments, so we think about payment suspensions due to credible allegations of fraud, we're required under state law to give written notice to the provider. I believe it's within 5 days after we implement the payment suspension. So typically, right, that's how the process works. Once we suspend payments due to credible allegations of fraud, we notify the provider. So those same concerns about like the provider not knowing about the investigation are typically not in place when we take actions to reduce or suspend payments. What I will say is that there's some concerns. I've talked to the Attorney General's office. There is a provision in federal law. It's CFR 42 CFR 455.23, which allows law enforcement to require the state to delay that notification to the provider. And I think that can be like up to 90 days, right? So sometimes we refer stuff to a provider, we suspend payments, the AG's office, maybe the federal law enforcement says, we don't want you notifying the provider for 90 days. So there may be some conflict between some of this language in federal law in terms of law enforcement can intervene in this situation and tell us not to disclose information to a provider.
Hmm. Thank you. Lead Pinto. Thank
you, Madam.
We do need to keep moving.
Yeah, no, understood, Madam Chair. Yeah, that's complicated. So I'm gathering from what the agency is saying is that in general, folks will know if the payment has been reduced, suspended, or withheld. There may be some circumstances where they might not. I'm just anticipating the verbal amendment to come. Rivers Hudson sort of trying to step through this. Because it seems to me that ultimately, we want to make sure there's not interference in investigation. Somebody has to decide that. I don't know that there's some automatic way to do it. I gather you have some concern about having the agency make that determination, and I understand that. I'll tell you that I was kind of brainstorming before putting together the A2. Is there some other path? And happy to have a conversation with you. Is there somebody else that could have that discretion or some way that the IG's discretion could be reviewed in some way? So anyway, that's an ongoing conversation. I know there's a few more committee stops. I'll just note I'm gathering that my amendment may get voted down by the majority, and then you'd be offering the verbal amendment. I do have process concerns about the verbal amendment, just to sort of give a preview about that. I know the chair is going to be able to waive rules if she chooses to do so. I want to make sure that we're making some kind of progress here. I guess we'll just sort of let the steps play out. But to confirm, very happy with transparency and disclosure, and we absolutely want to make sure we're not interfering with investigations and certainly interfering if there's some federal requirement, as the IG referenced. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Lead Pinto. So with that, all those in favor, we're going to vote on the A2, and then we'll go to the oral amendment. Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor of the A2 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
Nay.
Nay. The A2, it did not pass. Now, Representative Hudson, would you like to go to your oral amendment?
Yes, I would, and I would request that nonpartisan staff read what we have drafted up.
Good morning, Mr. Johnson. Please read the oral amendment.
Good morning, Chair, Representative Hudson and members. The oral amendment would read as follows. It would be page 2, line 16, after request, insert, if the commissioner has taken action to reduce, suspend, or withhold payments to the subject of the investigation.
Thank you. To your oral amendment, Representative Hudson.
The idea here is that we're working on the presumption that if payments have been withheld or reduced, then the subject of the investigation is aware that something's going on, and so disclosure of that investigation should be appropriate under those circumstances.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you. Just a quick question, and it may be for you, Representative Hudson or Inspector General Clark, and as somebody who's not a prosecutor, but it feels like to this question of if you've taken an action to reduce, suspend, or withhold payments already, that you may in some cases have sort of already started the process that will alert someone. So I assume in law enforcement investigations, especially if you're building a bigger case, you may want to withhold disclosure before the actions are taking that potentially will notify the target of the investigation. So I'm wondering if, again, if this leaves, if the way that this is drafted and sort of focusing on the actions, which I understand the intent, but leaves an area where we may either be conflicting with federal law or inadvertently being alerting people and sort of getting in the way of the investigation. And that might be a question for you, Inspector General Clark.
Inspector General Clark.
Thank you, Chair Robbins, Rep. Greenman. I'm having trouble following the language in the amendments. I don't have them in front of me. But yes, there can be reasons why law enforcement would not want to notify a subject about anything, right? Like there are concerns and investigations. I've seen it. Folks start deleting emails. They start destroying computers. They say, oh, my office was flooded. I no longer have any information. These are very serious concerns, right? So I think we just need to be careful and probably get law enforcement perspective on this too, whether it's the BCA, federal HHS, OIG, or the Attorney General's office about their concerns in terms of why they would want to delay notification for payment suspensions to providers.
Yes, Representative Greenman.
Thank you. Quick follow-up. That was going to be my next question is, have we, Representative Hudson, have you gotten technical or otherwise feedback from the BCA, from the AG's office, from the U.S. Attorney's office on this?
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Greenman. The answer to that is no.
Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have some substantive concerns with the amendment. I'll note that the commissioner having taken action to reduce, suspend, or withhold payments is not the same as the commissioner having reduced, suspended, or withheld payments. So even just their taking action to do so, I'd be worried that the subject of the investigation would not have been tipped off. I'll also note the IG reference, there may be situations where somebody actually doesn't know that payments have been reduced, suspended, or withheld. And of course, there's the concern that was referenced about potentially there could be situations where put in violation of federal law regarding the program. Having said that, this is better than the underlying bill. So on substance, I'd be inclined to support the change, recognizing there's a few more committee stops to go through. My bigger concern is just on process that the committee rules have a noon deadline the day before the committee. Minor oral amendments of a, quote, corrective or technical nature may be permitted at the chair's direction. I think that's like technical, cleaning up an error or something. I think that this doesn't fall in that. I think it'd be pretty hard to argue that it does. Madam Chair, you of course can waive committee rules. I would urge we want to do that very sparingly because it does seem to me, and honestly, Madam Chair, what I'd urge you to do is to hold off to allow this amendment to be offered in the ordinary course of a future hearing. I know there's several more committee stops, so you're probably very reluctant to do that. But I guess what I would ask at a future hearing, the minority may well want a rule waived, and we'll probably ask that happen and hope that can happen similarly to what's happening here. So as I say, I'm inclined to support the amendment substantively, but I do have concerns regarding the process of it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Lead Pinto, and I understand your concerns. We had a brief conversation before the hearing about that. And you and I spoke Friday about your concern in the A2, and this was our attempt to try to accommodate your concern, which we all share, that we don't want to tip off someone. We want transparency, and both goals are important. And so in that spirit that I told you about it, we provided copies. We're trying to work expeditiously because of all the committee stops and the short deadline, but we're also trying to work cooperatively. I am waiving the rule, and we are allowing the oral amendment, and I honestly hope you'll support it and that we can work together as it goes to other committees. So the idea, honestly, for the public to understand all the kind of back and forth is that we want to get to the point where we don't tip off fraudsters that an investigation is going, but once the people under investigation are aware of the investigation, who's under investigation should be reported to us as legislators or other people who make a request. It's not going to be like in some giant like website or something. It's on request. But for those of us who in the legislature, I gave a list of 72 childcare providers a year ago to DHS, and no one would ever tell me if they had done any follow-up. We had the same thing with an ICS provider at our hearing in September, and we never were told if they were doing any follow-up. I still to this day do not know if payment has been suspended. So in the interest of working cooperatively with the legislature, we need to compel the department to tell us what more of what they're doing once the people have been notified. So with that, there's a vote before the committee on Representative Hudson's oral amendment. Do we need to read it again? Okay, so all those in favor of adopting Representative Hudson's oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Thank you. The oral amendment is adopted. Now to the bill as amended, HF 3542 is, I renew Representative Hudson's motion to re-refer HF 3542 to the Committee on Children, Families, and...
Madam Chair,
I have a question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, Representative Elkins.
I had a question for staff, I think. So with reference to the Optum report, the section of the Data Practices Act that was referenced in all of the redactions, wasn't the investigative section, it was the trade secret section. So as a question for staff, but would the bill in its current form address redactions that were made pursuant to the trade secret section of the Data Practices Act?
Such a great question. Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Elkins, the disclosure that is authorized under here is simply the existence of an investigation. It wouldn't go to the details. And I think in probably all of the cases that you're thinking of, it would require disclosure of the details. And so I would say that it would not address that particular question. It's basically just a yes or no. Is there an investigation going on?
So,
Representative Elkins.
Yeah. So to the case at hand, the current Optum report, which has been heavily redacted, but under the Trade Secrets Act, would DHS be required to disclose that information? No.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Elkins, I'm going to say the answer is almost certainly no, unless somehow there's a trade secret connected to the existence of an investigation. I can't sit here think of a fact scenario where that would be the case, but it would not change anything related to the limitations on the trade secret unless that dealt exclusively with the existence of an investigation.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. All right, so I renew Representative Hudson's motion to re-refer HF 3542 as amended to the Committee on Children, Families, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Hudson. Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. I just want to make a comment while everyone's still in the room, including the testifiers. But I think we've seen it here. Unless this gets cleaned up and really cleaned up, you know, and fast, there's going to be a push probably to get rid of this program. And others, like the housing stabilization and so on. And it isn't just a matter of, you know, do they own a business? Do we know who owns it? You know, is there one person that has a license? It's beyond that, because there are citizens, children in the state that really, really need these services, really need these services. I wonder if they're actually getting services in many cases by professionals, you know? And medical professionals, or if they've got, you know, unprofessional 18-year-olds providing, you know, service. So it's a tragic that this is happening. And the quicker we clean this up and really clean it up, not just paper over it and go, oh, do you have a business license? Oh, do you have? That's not cleaning anything up. But the quicker we do this, the better off the people who really need these services are going to be. And so I hope that we're all working on, as somebody said, several people to fix it crew, because that's what needs to happen here in this and all the other programs. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. So sorry.
That's right.
And with that, we are adjourned. My presentation, I'll try and fit it in next week. Thank you.